Welcome to Sensible Disobedience, a podcast brought to you by the Carleton Chapter of Canadian Students for Sensible Drug Policy. We are here to bring you news, discussions, and interviews related to drugs and drug policy. Enjoy!
Okay, last time. This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
I don't see how people can honestly think that the prohibition of drugs works.
Does this concern you? It should concern you.
They probably started off with milk and then went to beer. And then they went to bourbon. And then they might have gone to marijuana. The gateway theory doesn't work.
This is crack.
The conservative government isn't making its decision based on evidence. Then what on earth are they basing it on?
I got some stuff you just gotta try. What is it? Pop. You know, marijuana.
But when you think about it, you can't make war on inanimate objects. You make war on people.
Hey, Priya.
Hey, Alex.
We are here again with the second episode of Sensible Disobedience. And what is our topic today?
HIV and AIDS. In light of World AIDS Day that just passed on December 1st.
Yes. Now, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, we have a number of news events that we're going to share with you all.
Current events / events that are current. Priya, what do we have today?
Well, there was an article about the Tories' new anti-drug campaign.
And what did that article say? Let me see.
It was about how the new anti-drug campaign is not exactly an accurate reflection.
Really? They should have listened to us.
I know.
So, it's in Maclean's on maclean's.ca, and here's the first paragraph. There's no denying the federal government's new anti-drug TV ad tells a disturbing story. A freshly scrubbed adolescent in her well-appointed bedroom looks like she might be about to relax with a couple Justin Bieber tunes.
Oh God, I hope not.
You know, she's that would be an even more disturbing. All right. Instead, an eerie soundtrack starts up.
One, two, kicked out of school,
sings a hollow, girlish voice straight out of a horror movie trailer.
Three, four, snort some more.
Soon she's trashing the room, then randomly snipping off some of her own hair and finally scratching at the angry needle marks on her forearm.
Five, six, need my fix.
It's a relief when the spooky carousel music stops and a calming adult narrator advises kids to check out Health Canada's Drugs Not For Me website. The ad, which is called Mirror, was launched November 17th by Health Minister Leona
Aglukkaq.
Okay. I don't want to mispronounce anybody's names. That's not something we like to make fun of here on the Sensible Disobedience podcast. Her department is spending $1.06 million to make the spot so ubiquitous. Is that how you...
Ubiquitous.
Ubiquitous on teen-oriented TV that two-thirds of 13 to 15-year-olds are expected to see it by next March.
I think this... I've seen this commercial somewhere already.
I've seen it on the bus, and
it's quite disturbing.
Well, it's disturbing, but also very
inaccurate.
You can't really understand it because I looked on the bus and it's like three pictures of this girl slowly looking,
morphing into a drug addict.
I couldn't even really identify it as drug addict. Like, she could have had just, I don't know, stayed up for a few nights, writing papers or something like that, and looked like that. And it says drugs. Where do you think they'll take you?
I don't know. Caffeine makes me stay awake for class.
Well, why did I get you a coffee then? If that's where this will take you.
No, well, I think that the biggest problem with this ad is that it's missing a lot of important information. Like, why did she start using? Was she offered by a friend? Was she going through some problems. Like, there's so many reasons why people use drugs.
They don't show her using drugs.
They show the before and after, but there's no accurate, like, demonstration of her actually sitting down and snorting coke as it's so described in the freaky song.
Drugs are this. It's not even a tangible thing that you can identify her doing. You can't. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyways, we've talked about that and it's silly. What is our next
piece? Health Canada continues on their sensational approach to drug use. Happy news.
Happy news?
Yes.
Okay.
Bill S-10 has not passed in the Senate.
Hooray!
Apologies to all of you who may have thought that it passed while looking it up online. I know I was misguided because I was on Cannabis Culture, I believe.
I believe that was the same.
And I heard there was an article that said it passed on November 4th, and so I was very confused. I was like, what? But it didn't even make big news. But in actuality, it hasn't passed.
I believe it was the Vancouver Sun who published the original piece, and of course, we all heard it and got so disheartened. So we published that news here, and
we're happy to say that we were wrong.
And we don't always readily admit that we're wrong or that we're happy that we're wrong, but we were, and that's not saying that it won't pass eventually. And I wanted to add this, that even if it does pass, that won't mean that we won't stop fighting it. Yet, the fact that it didn't actually pass gives me, and I'm pretty sure you too, Priya, a little bit of hope to fight it a little more, and just makes us feel like there's a little bit more of a chance.
Yeah. I don't know how much time we might have, and I know it's the holidays, so it's going to be a bit more tedious to mobilize at this time with people, but we can continue spreading the word on all sorts of social mediums that it has not passed, and so do whatever you can, write a letter or talk to people about this and let everyone know that it's a bad bill.
And actually, Priya, I think I discussed with you having our next podcast, a Bill S-10 podcast.
Yeah, that's a fabulous idea.
So if any of you have any comments on Bill S-10 or any questions, any feedback, please, you can either post on the blog, which is sensibledisobedience, all one word, .blogspot.com. You can
email us at cu.cssdp@gmail.com.
You can go on the Facebook page, which just look on the little Facebook search for Carlton CSSDP. Maybe we might even make a Sensible Disobedience page of our own, but all in due time. And let us know what you think. It can, even if it's a one sentence little Bill S-10 sucks, that would be awesome.
We'll try to include it in the next podcast.
Thank you. Okay, next bit of news.
AP impact. Cartel arrests did not curb drug page.
Okay.
Trade.
I will, and this is, yeah, the Associated Press published this. Okay, here's what they wrote. On a sleepy boulevard of motels and fast food joints near the Mexican border, police stopped a car with a broken taillight. In the trunk, he found a trash bag containing 48 pounds of narcotics, and in the driver's pocket, scraps of paper scrawled with phone numbers. Almost 4 years later, a grave Eric Holder called his first news conference as Attorney General and announced that those numbers had led to a sweeping investigation called Operation Accelerator. an accelerator is without an E at the front, it's just an X.
C-E-L-L-E-R-A-T.
Kind of like, have you seen the experiment website where you can, it's pretty awesome. We'll put that in the show notes, guys, and on our blog. You can do little, it's very hard to explain.
You can see how marijuana dries up the eye.
But only Earl, the eyeball.
A.K.A. Earl.
It's a floating eyeball named Earl, and you can put drugs into his pupil.
Ugh.
And basically it sort of shows how drugs affect him, quote unquote. It doesn't really, but it's a fun way to spend an afternoon just giving him drugs. Anyways,
so Operation Accelerator, what was this all about?
It produced the largest ever federal crackdown on Mexico's Sinaloa drug cartel, with 761 people arrested and 23 tons of narcotics seized. So, yes, standing with Holder that day in 2009 was Acting Drug Enforcement Administration Chief Michelle Leonhardt, who declared, "Today we have dealt with the Sinaloa drug cartel a crushing blow." But just how crushing was it? An Associated Press investigator cast doubt on whether the crackdown caused any significant setback for the cartel. It still ranks near the top of Mexico's drug gangs, and most of those arrests were underlings who had little connection with the cartel and were swiftly replaced. The cartel leader remains free, along with his top commanders. The findings confirm what many critics of the drug war have said for the past years. The government is quick to boast about large amounts or drug seizures, large arrests or drug seizures, but many of its most publicized efforts result in little, if any, slowdown in the drug trade. So, I think that's the basis, I think, of the article is, you know.
And this was recent, right? It was posted about
3 days ago.
So December 1st, 2nd.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny how a lot of times officers in drug enforcement, they believe that once they've made a big arrest of this kind, that they've made some, like, as they said, dealt a huge blow to the whole drug trade in itself. But in reality, they've done nothing. Because as soon as they take away one top dog, somebody is right underneath them ready to replace
him.
Well,
it's not even a top dog. It's like,
he was just the guy distributing the drugs.
It's the, you know, underling. It's the it's the person who's probably involved just to support their own habit.
Yeah.
So
it's like one of those computer games, like where you think you think you've made it, like you've made a small advancement to the next level, but then it just keeps getting harder and harder.
And there's this, you think it's this big villain, but it's only like the first little tiny,
the first one in an endless amount.
Cycle.
Yeah.
And you
can't.
That's
why I was never good at video games.
Yeah, that's why I quit.
I quit
and then I started my own little harm reduction program in Super Mario, where all the little turtles got, you don't have to go and eat
mushrooms.
Okay, let's stop. What happened next?
Well, oh, great news. Safe injection sites in Montreal, was it? In Montreal and other parts of Quebec will be opening with or without permission from the government. More on this, Alex?
Addiction support groups are preparing to open safe injection sites for drug addicts in Montreal and Quebec City next June, even if the province doesn't approve them. The legality of Canada's only safe injection site in Vancouver will be tested by the Supreme Court of Canada next spring, and Quebec's health minister has said he will wait for the decision before taking a position on these issues. But a coalition of support groups working with drug addicts contends the sites are a matter of utmost urgency because the transmission of HIV and Hep C is reaching epidemic proportions in the province. And they basically can't wait any longer. And they feel that these sites, they have to go up. And whether
because there's a demand for them, people need harm reduction.
And sometimes you have to do the right thing, which is what I said on the I made a little comment on the link on the CSSVP Facebook page, but nonetheless. I am very happy that they're coming, and I know anyone who's involved in this knows that it's necessary and that they are good things. What saddens me is InSight, for example, it faces so much heat from the government, actually, law enforcement officers around downtown east side of Vancouver, they actually are more or less in support of InSight because they know the good things that it does.
Yeah, because they're working in the midst of many, like, hardcore drug users.
But I think the issue is, for me, as excited as I am that they will go up for it, and I mean, we explained, we're sensible disobedience. Sometimes you have to go against the law in order to do what's right, and...
Because imagine if they had to wait until they got permission. I mean, the people that are going to use these sites would have to wait, like, longer and longer and continue... I don't know.
However, it makes me sad that I can only imagine what they're going to face when they put these up. All the political, legal backlash, and I don't really know where exactly I'm going with this, but it needs to happen, but I am anticipating a big, shitnik, really.
But in any case, we are in support of these injection sites.
And we are.
I anticipate when they'll go up, and as Alex said, there will most likely be backlash, and we'll just have to support them in any way we can and ride through it and do all we can to make sure they stay up.
And that more are appointed, and that maybe one day our government and the general public will agree that they are what we need and they are legitimate, and that I think they're a human right, really, because drug users, we could go on and on forever about supervised injection sites, but...
But if you know of anyone who is opposed to the idea of safe injection sites, I mean, I know that there are close-minded people out there, but I believe
Priya, there's a lot of open-minded people who are really...
And sometimes the reason why someone might seem close-minded is because maybe they haven't heard an explanation that resonates with them. Because sometimes they just have to hear something that resonates with them or something they can relate to in some way, and then they'll open up to the idea and start to understand it. So if you know of someone who... Well, I'm not saying go out there and convince everybody that you know that supervised injection sites are the right thing, which they are, but... I mean, just do your part, and if you care a lot about this issue, then one thing you can do is to just share share why they're important to you and why they're important to society, really.
But as you say that, I actually had a long discussion with a friend of mine who, actually, she might even be listening now. Hi, Claire. And she said to me, well, if we voted, I don't even think we really did vote, so to say, on safe injection sites, but if the majority of Canadians don't want these up, then they shouldn't be up. However... I don't think that, for one thing, a majority of Canadians have all the right information. Mm-hmm. And they may not, well, probably aren't the ones who are affected by this. They aren't the ones who are
needing.
They aren't the ones who are, who don't have a place to get a clean needle and are in the position of using a dirty one. They aren't the ones who might suffer a drug overdose in a, well, I know this is stereotypical, but a dark alley somewhere. And
they aren't the ones more vulnerable to getting HIV or AIDS.
And, you know, yes, we're a democracy and the majority rules. Well, I don't agree. Sometimes the majority's wrong and
or the, not well informed.
And the minority is the one that suffers. And just because a group is in a minority doesn't mean that their interests should be less.
Anyways, agrees. Well said, Alex.
A rant of the... Well, no. This is going to be a very ranty episode. So hang in there. So what do we have next, Priya?
Well, next we have some news items that relate to World AIDS Day that just happened on December 1st. First, we have Youth RISE, which stands for Resource Information Support and Education for Reducing Drug-Related Harm. There was an article that came up on World AIDS Day from Mexico City that a youth-driven training manual for HIV prevention was created to educate, empower and educate young people, reduce stigma, and save lives. And what it said in the, some of what it said in the article was that whilst young people are most vulnerable to HIV infection, they also embody the greatest potential for change. And I really loved that. Empowering and educating young people on how to reduce harms and prevent HIV infection in an open and non-judgmental space is critical for positive health outcomes. So this manual was put together over a span of 2 years, and it was the result of a series of workshops conducted in 2009 and 2010 by young people in Romania, India, Canada, and Mexico. So quite a large span of the globe. And so, yeah, it was created by young people and for young people, and it's going to be distributed, I believe, all throughout these countries so that young people have the tools they need or the information they need for HIV prevention, substance use, and sexual health.
Excellent.
Yeah.
What next, Priya?
Oh, and similar to that story, the Canadian Auto Workers Union created their own information manual called HIV AIDS, A Workers' Issue, A Union Issue. And CA President Ken Lawenza said in the article, which you can find at www.caw.ca/human rights, he said, "Today, one in 500 Canadians is living with HIV and AIDS, but up to 30% do not even realize this." And he also went on to say that many of our CA members are living with HIV/AIDS, and yet the silence and stigma surrounding the disease continues to prevent those who contract the virus from getting the support they need, and it continues to be the major factor in the continued spread of the infection. So I thought this was a very important point that he brought up, that the stigmatization of people living with HIV and AIDS is what is keeping people from engaging in, I guess, safer sexual practices, and it creates this fear around the whole, around HIV and AIDS. And so when you can't have an open and honest dialogue with people, and when resources aren't available for people who have HIV and AIDS, then becomes a hushed up topic, and which isn't safe. So next on current news, on our Twitter account, I saw that someone had posted an article from the IPPF website, International Planned Parenthood Federation, and their article was entitled, "What's the Impact of Criminalizing HIV Transmission?" And I thought, well, this is an angle that we could include. And so what they said is, what they found was that criminalizing HIV transmission risks further marginalizing people already vulnerable to HIV infection, including women, men who have sex with men, sex workers, and people who use drugs. By fueling stigma, criminalization undermines efforts to prevent, treat, and care for HIV. This simplistic law and order response to HIV can intensify a climate of denial, secrecy, and fear, and thus provide a fertile breeding ground for the spread of HIV. Jan Albert, professor of infectious diseases at the Karolinska Institute of Sweden, said, "Do we want to turn a proportion of our population into potential criminals every time they have sex?" And this article was part of IPPF's Criminalize Hate, Not HIV campaign, which was made for World AIDS Day. One interesting fact I also found was that in some countries, such as Canada and the US, laws have been used to send mothers to prison for transmitting HIV to their child. Isn't that ridiculous?
That is... It's problematic on so many different levels.
One website that I found was one.org/international/act-now/no-child. Okay, that's a lot to remember, but we'll put it for you in the notes of this episode. And it's a petition. There's a petition on there that you can sign, you or anyone can sign, which is look for the goal that no child will be born with HIV by 2015, which is in 5 years. So I encourage all of you to go and check out the website and sign the petition. One is a grassroots advocacy and campaigning organization that fights extreme poverty and preventable disease, particularly in Africa, by raising public awareness and pressuring political leaders to support smart and effective policy and programs that are saving lives. The one program they have going on right now, or what they're advocating for, is to live in a world where no child is born with HIV. What the petition says is, "Dear world leaders, by 2015, we can make sure no child is born with HIV. It all starts with an agreement at the United Nations to combat extreme poverty, with every country doing their bit. Please do yours. Thank you." And then you can sign.
Now, when we look at no one, campaign, it's awesome, but we need to, it doesn't on this website directly address drug policy when it really should. Now, how do you think that is, Priya? We can edit things too.
Well, what I can say from what I know so far is that HIV is transmitted through, can be transmitted sexually or through sharing needles and drug and intravenous drug use. And so the threat of criminalizing mothers for passing HIV onto their children is that in a lot of instances they might not know that they're passing it on because they are unable to get tested before they have the baby, or they don't. They might know, but they can't.
They don't
prevent having. I don't know.
Oh, it's all right, dear. No, that's true, and sorry, I need to get some stats. Well. And if we're going to consider Canada, let's see, in 1996, it's estimated that over half of all new HIV infections is related to injection drug use and practices, I'm assuming, such as sharing, used equipment, needles, cookers, spoons, those sort of things. And this obviously is transmitted from user to user, and Once a user gets pregnant, they become a mother, yada, yada, yada. But an interesting fact is that the spread of HIV from mother to baby in utero is almost completely preventable with treatment.
Really? Why don't they teach that in school?
I don't know. But the risks of mother-to-child transmission of HIV can be reduced to below 1% if the appropriate use of anti-HIV drugs is used during pregnancy and labor, and if cesarean delivery is available, and if you have a detectable viral load, they'll use the C-section. I'll tell you a bit about a viral load. Okay, viral loads / CD4 cell counts. T cells are white blood cells that play an important role in the immune system. There are two types of T cells. One type of molecule has molecules called CD4 on its surface, and these are the helper cells, which organize the immune system's response to bacteria, fungi, and viruses. The other T cells have a molecule called CD8, which destroys cells that are infected and produce antiviral substances. HIV is able to attach itself on the CD4 molecule, allowing the virus to enter and infect these cells. Even while a person with HIV feels well and has no symptoms, billions of CD4 cells are infected by HIV and are destroyed every day, and billions more CD4 cells are produced to replace them. A viral load count. Doctors use a test that counts the number of CD4 cells in a cubic millimeter of blood. A normal CD4 count in a healthy HIV-negative adult can vary, but it's usually between 600 and 1,200 CD4 cells per cubic millimeter of blood. Your doctor will normally just talk about CD4 cell counts as a number. In some cases, in order to help understand changes in your CD4 count, your doctor may assess what the proportion of lymphocytes is to CD4 cells. This is called a CD4 percentage. In HIV-negative people, a normal test result is about 40%. A CD4 percentage that falls below 15% is understood to reflect a risk of severe infections. The drugs that can prevent HIV from being passed from mother to baby are called antiretroviral drugs. These can also be taken by an HIV-positive woman when they're not pregnant to prevent them from becoming ill. The most important time for an HIV-positive woman to take antiretrovirals to prevent her baby from becoming infected is during labor. Depending on your particular circumstances, it may be suggested that they're used at other times as well. Another option is to take short course of combination antiretroviral therapy during the last few months of pregnancy in order to get your viral load to below 50 copies per millimeter. Then you could have a vaginal delivery. And then your baby will receive treatment with antiretroviral syrup for 4 weeks after it's born. If this is all done right, there's the chances of the kid being born with HIV is very, very low.
Wow, so there's hope.
There is.
And if only more people knew about these services, or if only they were more accessible.
That's the thing. If this woman is a drug user, I don't think that they'd be very willing to go and receive prenatal care because of all that stigma.
Because she's so stigmatized and she wouldn't feel... Well, I'm guessing she wouldn't be respected as she should be.
And she wouldn't have probably access to information about this treatment. I mean, a lot of people who I tell that, you know, if you're HIV positive and you're pregnant, that's not like a death sentence for the kid. It's not even, it doesn't even mean that the kid will be ill when it's born. So, but if, as I said, if you're a drug user,
then you need to listen to these podcasts.
Well, and just people in general need to listen to it. Part of, and it's funny that, how would I say this? The UN has this thing, and it's called the Commission of the Rights of the Child. And there's a whole bunch of, a Declaration of the Rights of the Child. And it has various principles. The child will be, enjoy, the child who is,
physically,
here, sorry, okay, for one thing, the child will be protected from practices which foster racial, religious, or any other type of discrimination. And discriminating to mothers on the basis of HIV status or, you know, whether or not they're a drug user, it will cause the child to suffer if they are infected with HIV. One of the others is the child shall enjoy the benefits of Social Security, where they are entitled to grow and develop in health. To this end, special care and protection shall be provided to the child and the child's mother, including adequate prenatal and postnatal care. The child will have right to adequate nutrition, housing, recreation, and medical services. So if a woman who uses drugs and is infected with HIV is discriminated upon, you are in turn discriminating against the child as well. Mm-hmm. And I know that this may seem like we're grasping for different things, but it's all interrelated. And
definitely.
Yeah. So Priya, we've discussed some news events, and just basically tried to wrap a big,
huge issue,
such as HIV/AIDS, and how it has a big relation to drug policy. And I find it very funny because I know a lot of people who are very much, consider themselves, you know, to be very knowledgeable about HIV/AIDS, and to be very, you know, they'll buy their red ribbon on
World AIDS Day,
and, you know, they consider themselves to be passionate and progressive, but have such such little knowledge about HIV in the drug using community, and
or they look down upon women or mothers who have children while they're infected with HIV. They look down upon mothers who choose to have children.
Not only mothers, Priya, but basically they don't consider they. It's almost like HIV is acceptable in those populations because they deserve it somehow for being drug users. That's the sense that I get from a lot of people who seem to dismiss the issue. They seem to think of it as this far-off issue in sub-Saharan Africa with AIDS orphans and
or something to a big issue amongst the gay population.
Or they just, and they can, and I know some people who consider themselves so well informed about HIV AIDS, but yet they support the war on drugs. They don't know anything about harm reduction. And that's really sad because it's...
because they're all interrelated.
And it's such a huge part of it. So basically, what we want you to get from this episode is HIV/AIDS policy and drug policy, they are definitely interconnected. We need to reduce the stigma of people with HIV/AIDS.
As well as the stigma of drug users.
We can't combat one of them without combating the other. And to solve both issues, we have to look at them both. And what else, Priya?
And realize that all people who, or all drug users, as well as people who are infected with HIV/AIDS or possibly both, mm-hmm. are, when it comes down to it, they're people. They're not aliens. There's nothing wrong with them. We just have to acknowledge that we're all people, and we have to look at the risks involved and how we can reduce risks, harm reduction,
and this is a public health issue. It's not a moral issue. It's not a legal issue.
Exactly. Once you've contracted HIV, it doesn't mean your life is over.
And just because you're a drug addict doesn't mean that your life is over. Just because you've tried drugs doesn't mean your life is over.
No. And that's one of the big problems with the way HIV/AIDS and drug use and drug addiction is talked about in the media, is that they look at it as if once you're contracted with HIV/AIDS or you have you have a drug abuse problem, then all of a sudden you've gone down the wrong path. There's no coming back. But that's not the reality.
No, it is not. So we will wrap up today, and we hope to hear your feedback about this podcast. We'd love to hear from you. And if you have anything to say for our next podcast, which is about Bill S10, and anything
else, please get in touch with us.
Please do. On our blog, or I think you can put comments on our iTunes thing. So if you can figure out how to do that, go nuts.
And all the articles that we referenced in this podcast will be up on the blog, so you can check that our information is accurate.
Or, you know, you can go and educate yourself, but no, you should go and make sure that we're not shitting
that we're not lying. No, but all the articles are incredible, and if you have the time, I would encourage you to read some of them, if not all.
All right, so remember, everybody,
be sensible and stay sensible.
Bye.
Hello again, everybody. This is Alex recording solo a little bit after Priya and I had initially started recording the podcast. We started recording last week, and we got through the news, as you heard, pretty well, and it was all going pretty splendidly, but we really felt that we had only scratched the surface on the topic of HIV/AIDS and drug policy. And realistically, even with this stuff that I am going to add, we will always just have scratched the surface. But this is just to get you guys a little bit more aware and informed. Sorry that this is such a delay in recording. Priya and I are just such busy people leading such... we're students... And I had a really fun trip to the ER because I felt like I wanted to take out my eyeball with the melon baller or an ice cream scoop. And it was just a delightful experience. And it kind of hurt to like look at anything like a computer screen. Anyways, I'm here now and I'm going to discuss a bit more about HIV/AIDS and drug policy. Now, I saved a little document on my computer and it says, what the hell does HIV/AIDS have to do with drug policy? I did not go and research this a lot. Most of this information is from the HIV/AIDS Policy and Law Review, Volume 15, Number 1, which was released in October of 2010, so just a couple months ago. And it was created by the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. So this is a legitimate source, worry not. There are quite a few subjects that they mention, and I just wanted to use this as a way to explain how HIV/AIDS relates to drug policy. And I will read their first couple paragraphs. In many countries around the world, drug control efforts result in serious human rights abuses, torture and ill treatment by police, mass incarceration, extrajudicial killings, arbitrary detention, denial of essential medicines and basic health services. Drug control policies and accompanying enforcement practices often entrench and exacerbate systematic discrimination against people who use drugs and impede access to controlled essential medicines for those who need them for therapeutic purposes. Local communities in drug-producing countries also face violations of their human rights as a result of campaigns to eradicate illicit crops, including environmental damage, displacement, and damage to health from chemical spraying. These abuses are widespread and systematic. They are cause for considerable concern in themselves, but they are also impeding an effective response to the AIDS epidemic by denying people who use drugs access to proven, effective HIV prevention, care, and treatment services, and by contributing to at least 1 million people living with HIV/AIDS going without adequate treatment to address moderate to severe pain. Unsafe injecting practices put people who inject drugs at a high risk of HIV transmission. Outside of sub-Saharan Africa, up to 30% of all HIV infections occur through injection drug use. In some countries, in particular in Central and Eastern Europe and East Asia, injection drug use is the primary driver of HIV epidemics. In some places, up to 80% of people living with HIV are likely to have acquired the virus through unsafe injection practices. Evidence suggests that more than 3 million people who inject drugs worldwide are living with HIV. So, despite the overwhelming evidence in favor of harm reduction as an effective HIV prevention strategy, the global state of harm reduction is poor, to say the least. According to the IHRA, I'm guessing that's the International Harm Reduction Association, sounds right, eh? There are at least 78 countries where injection drug use has been documented, but no harm reduction services are available. And even when they say that a country does have harm reduction services, often these services are provided completely through NGOs and only have, you know, slim to none government support. Meaning, and so they don't have funding, and obviously they're usually not very popular with the public either because of social stigma, so they don't have too much private donations either. And even though they are legal in many countries, they will still be targeted by the police. These agencies. basically coverage levels with harm reduction programs sufficient to avert or reverse HIV epidemics have only been implemented in parts of Western Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. As I said about funding, funding for harm reduction is very low globally, and it's not representative of what is needed to address the HIV epidemic among injecting drug users, nor proportionate to injection-driven HIV transmission versus sexual transmission. In many countries, harm reduction is further hampered by criminal laws. Disproportionate penalties and law enforcement practices can drive people away from health and harm reduction services that do exist and can lead to more forms of risky forms of drug use. And when people are imprisoned for drug offenses, harm reduction services become pretty much non-existent. Only 10 countries worldwide have needle exchange programs in prison, and only 37 have opioid substitution therapy, which is methadone, is what most people would think of. So, obviously, that is problematic. One part of this review that caught my eye is a part where they discuss the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child. When I took a social work with children and youth course, this was sort of what, as a social worker working with children and youth, that you sort of practice by. There are these rights that we, as a global community, have decided that children, which is defined individuals age 17 and under, are entitled to special rights because of, I guess, I don't want to say vulnerability, but just it's a stage in your life where you're entitled to certain protection and certain entitlements to ensure that you lead a successful life for how many more years you're... Anyways, it's a rights-based perspective that I think most people would be pretty supportive of. In Article 33 of the Convention of the Rights of the Child, it requires that state parties, and this is to quote it, take all appropriate measures, including legislative, administrative, social, and educational measures, to protect children from the illicit use of narcotic drugs and psychotropic substances as defined in the relevant international treaties. The Committee of the Rights of the Child stated that injecting practices with unsterile equipment further enhances the risk of HIV transmission. No shit, Sherlocks. The committee notes that greater understanding is needed for substance abuse behaviors among children, including the impact that neglect and violation of the rights of the child have on these behaviors. In most countries, children do not have access to more pragmatic HIV prevention programs that are related to substance use, as these programs, if they do exist, are mainly targeted at adults. So, the committee has called for the provision of necessary evidence-based support, recovery, and reintegration services to all children affected by substance abuse, aimed at effectively reducing the harmful consequences of such abuse. Blah, blah, blah. You know, all that jargon. Basically, they recognize that using unsterile equipment and not allowing young people access to harm reduction programs puts them at risk of HIV transmission, and yet they often, young people don't have access to harm reduction. We're going to have an episode on harm reduction in the future, so, you know, we're going to discuss it more in detail, but I thought that it was pretty relevant and important when, because we're very focused on youth and how drug policy that is so, that is implemented in the, for the intention of protecting young people actually harms us and often can put us at a greater chance of contracting HIV. Now, when I think about this and reflect on it, I do understand a bit of why these laws are put in place from a bit of a social workish perspective. Before you all get mad at me, I'm not saying that it's right, but there is a bit of a, there's a fine line you gotta trace. Though, obviously, I believe that harm reduction services should be accessible and open to everyone. I think one thing that gets in the way is, as substance use it does have risks involved in it. Even with harm reduction services, you can't eliminate those risks. And when you put young people / technically children in at risk, that is technically child abuse or neglect in particular. And I'm guessing that many would see that allowing children to have access to harm reduction could in turn be viewed as neglect. I don't quite know how to respond to that, because if you think of it in an extreme, I mean, if someone's, I don't know, 5-year-old is injecting heroin into his eyeballs, I don't know, that would be negligent. That's not healthy for a young child to do. Obviously, that isn't that realistic an example, but there is a point where do you draw the line? Where is it representative that a child is not safe if they are using drugs? Can we say that it's a lifestyle choice? Can we say that it's that, you know, someone should be punished for letting that happen? Well, I think all of us need to take responsibility for letting that happen. There are a lot of things, there are a lot of factors that will influence whether or not young people do turn to substances, and I don't know what the proper approach is. I obviously don't know enough about child protection or substance abuse treatment or pop to know what the answer is, but for the time being, we don't want young people to get HIV, and we're going to have to do more than what's being done right now. As we look more at specific policies that increase the rates of risky drug use behaviors, Some of these are such things as drug paraphernalia laws. In many countries, carrying drug paraphernalia, such as needles, syringes, crack pipes, etc., is illegal. This can deter safer drug use, as you know, people will want to conceal their use to avoid police attention, and it obviously can deter the initiation of harm reduction services. And you know, if possession of these this equipment is illegal, then you can't really distribute it. Also, there's enticement or encouragement or aiding and abetting laws. And these are laws that create criminal penalties for enticement to use drugs or facilitating slash encouraging drug use. And these exist in many countries. These laws aren't really based on the reality of how drug use is initiated. It's often between peers or siblings or friends who are also using. And they can act as a deterrent to harm reduction services. And harm reduction services are frequently accused of facilitating drug use. I think we've all sort of heard this argument as one to sort of go against, as an argument against harm reduction services, that somehow it encourages drug use. I've never really thought of that logically. I can't really imagine being, if you're going to be using drugs, or you're making the choice to engage in drug use or not, be like, well, I can get clean, I can get free or clean needles or crack pipes. Well, there we go. I think when you're being this is just my opinion, I can't back this up by studies, but when you're being introduced into it, I don't know if your health is really the first thing that comes into your mind. You're already sort of, I would guess, being vulnerable, and you begin engaging in a behavior knowing it's risky. So I can't really see how, yes, obviously, as somebody who doesn't use, you know, reducing, not wanting to contract HIV AIDS, yes, that's a reason. I can't even say that, because I don't think, well, no, transmission of bloodborne infections, they're not a characteristic of drug use itself. Just because if that were so, we'd be saying that, you know, diabetics who inject insulin are more at risk for HIV transmission. That's not the case, because they have access to needles easily, and arguably, yes, you still have to pay for them, and yes, blah, 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 but they're not criminalized for it, so they don't feel like it needs to be hidden. So now I'm going to, well, if anyone actually listens to this podcast and has diabetes, please don't write in. And, well, actually, we'd like anybody to write in. So if you're angry, please write in. But I'm not trying to say that drug use and diabetes is the same thing. But you guys are smart. You get what point I'm trying to make. The last point that I wanted to add about drug policy and HIV/AIDS is the issue of medical marijuana. What I found out is marijuana is widely recognized for its effectiveness in treating symptoms related to HIV/AIDS, such as nausea, lack of appetite, nerve pain, depression, anxiety, and sleeping problems. Especially with the new drugs that we have now, people with HIV can live longer and better, but they have some pretty intense side effects. Especially, and nausea from these medications is one of them, and it causes lack of appetite, and marijuana can help that. These medications also cause pain via peripheral neuropathy, and again, marijuana can help that with fewer side effects than many prescription medications. It's been shown to have to increase the amount of serotonin. I don't know exactly how that is measured, but that's what it says. Oh, and I will give all the information that I gathered, most of it from AIDSlaw.ca, I believe. There's various reports that I collected information from, and I'll post them all on the blog. And if I can figure out how to do show notes, I'll do that as well. So in conclusion, what the hell does HIV/AIDS have to do with drug policy? A lot, as you have heard by my blabbering. It just further exemplifies that drug substance use should not be viewed as a criminal justice issue, but a public health issue. And there's so much irony in the fact that we impose these laws because the use of drugs is unhealthy and causes all these harms, when the harms that result from the policies, to me, seem quite a bit worse. And as we advocate, we need sensible drug policies that prevent HIV/AIDS, that allow people to, if they are using drugs, if they already are going to be facing other health risks related to drug use, HIV shouldn't be one of them. And it's a human rights issue. No matter, okay, I'm not, we can argue this, but I don't think that people deserve HIV/AIDS, that no one deserves HIV/AIDS. Whether or not you think that drug use and addiction is a choice, I don't think, nobody chooses to be infected with HIV. And I don't, if you think that drug use is simply a matter of irresponsibility, if that's what your idea of punishing drug users is, it's not working and it's not right. So fuck you if you think that. So I'm just sitting in my jammies with my cat. We're probably going to watch some Glee episodes together. Hopefully, I will have this episode edited and ready by the end of tonight, or, okay, technically very early, Saturday, December 11th. And later today, Priya and I will be recording the third episode of Sensible Disobedience, which will be focused on Bill S-10. If you have any comments or feedback, we'd love to hear from you. Hope you enjoyed this. Hopefully I'll have a co-host for the rest, for all of the next episode. Thank you, and have a splendiferous, well, I guess it'll be a couple days, not a week, but have a splendiferous weekend, guys.